The leaves are falling, the air is getting colder, and you know what that means. It's time for video games and a Radio Free Nintendo. Hi there. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. This is episode 309, and with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette,
editor extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire. And James Jones.
Not last week.
And this week, subbing in for John Lindemann, who is still on indefinite leave. And I'm sure he appreciates all the well wishes he's been receiving. But we have our very, very good friend and Kirby expert, Michael T.Y.P. Cole.
Hi.
Haunting.
Nicely done, sir. So Mike is going to be a very valuable asset in the second segment of the show when we talk about Kirby and the Amazing Mirror for Retroactive. I am really looking forward to this conversation. We've got some interesting comments from the forums, and It's just a weird game that I think there's a lot to say and a lot to discuss. So I can't wait for that, but we are going to wait for it, because first up, we got new business, and James has something hot off the presses that he's got to talk about.
So today was the release day for the three add-on packs of New Super Mario Bros. 2, at least the first three. Amongst them were the incredibly hard challenge levels, the levels that have a top 10 scoreless, or a scoreless rather. And a game, a level that would be called It's All About the Gold. For whatever reason, Nintendo determined that not all three of these should have leaderboards, because that would be logical, insane, and rational, and only put them in one.
Mm-hmm.
And that all three of these should not be gold frenzies, they should put that in one, and that not all three of these should be challenging. So you have to pick what you want. So I decided, you know, my inner gamer was saying I have to get the hard levels because I've beaten the game, and I beat the game pretty easily, so I should probably do that. But the part of me that wants to get a million gold said, fuck that, let's get the really, really ridiculously over-the-top gold-collecting one. And that one happened to be controlling the stylus at the moment I selected a level. So I got It's All About the Gold level pack, which
that
is...
That one seems like the most fun to me. That's probably the one I would get if I were inclined to spend more money on this game that I've already spent far too much money on.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not bothered by the price. You know, it's basically $1 per level, but I actually already had the money in the 3DS, and it was locked up there. And it
That's
wasn't
how
really
they
enough.
Get you.
It wasn't... Well, actually, it was just enough to get it, so it wasn't really enough to get anything of value on the 3DS, because anything that's basically $250 is going to be not...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Can you add more money from within the game, or do you have to go to the eShop to add more money and then go to the game to buy it?
You can add more. I checked that out. You actually can add more money from the game itself.
Smart. Okay.
It basically pops up the bottom screen of the eShop at that point. It's the exact same interface. It's kind of weird.
Okay.
The button went live today for people who go to the level shop, or whatever they call it, and buy new levels. So that's what I did. Speaking of the gold level, levels, I guess is the better way of putting it. They are absurd. If you've played the game, you're familiar with the boat level, which is a level in which a boat flies through the air, and you can drop a shell on the bottom deck that bounces around and collects coins when you're in It's All About the Gold mode. The thing about these levels is that there's gold flowers literally everywhere, so you're always have gold fireballs, and there's gold rings everywhere to turn everything into gold-spawning monsters. So the whole level is just freaking chaos. There's another level where the entire level is made of the blocks that turn into coins when you shoot them with the gold fireballs. It's stupid. I cleared 12,000 on an attempt so far. I've only played about 5 times, which is a lot of gold. My previous record was 6. It's the levels themselves are incredibly non-challenging. They have a 5-star difficulty level, and it's just a 1. But I would like them to have been a little bit harder.
I'm sorry, this sounds so gimmicky. As someone who hasn't played this game at all.
It's very gimmicky.
But the stuff that they're focusing on is honestly the most fun part of the main game. I mean, to me, those levels where they just give you the golden fire flower and they say, just go crazy. I mean, I wouldn't want a whole game to be like that, of course, but it really does, to me, those are the levels where it feels like the game is doing something new that you haven't done before. Because you do kind of get this sense of carving through the level with your golden fireballs. Right. And it doesn't make you invincible. So you still have to actually play thoughtfully, even though you're really powerful.
Yeah, it's a weird stage. It really makes the levels that you, when you beat the game, you get to have one gold flower in your reserves when you play Coin Rush. It makes that feel like ridiculous, because basically there's gold flowers everywhere. So you're just blasting gold. And yeah, I mean, it is really gimmicky. And I think in terms of a gameplay standpoint, the difficult levels are probably more rewarding. But just in terms of the sheer ridiculousness, this is probably the better option. It is incredibly stupid, though, that not all of these levels have score lists. It doesn't make any sense. I guess Nintendo had to put some gimmick onto the middle tier one, but they could have done better than that.
But the score list is only like a global ranking, I think. It's not even like against your 3DS friends.
It's not even in-game. You have to go to a website.
Are you shitting me?
I believe so, yes. It sounds,
dude, that's fucking crazy.
It sounds
I hope that's
incredibly
not.
Bodged together. But yeah. It is what it is.
I mean, Coin Rush, I mean, of course, these are Coin Rush packs, so they still have Street Pass, and I think that'll be fun, but the problem is, not everybody you Street Pass with is going to have these levels,
nope.
So it's going to really limit the number of people who can actually trade data for these packs. But then also, like, they've shown now, they've kind of broken the dam on, you know, having some kind of online leaderboard, and yet they've just done it in the most shitty way that you could do it. And
well, they 1/3 did it in the most shitty way you could do it.
Yeah, only one of the packs even supports that. So
really, it should have been the whole game to start with, or patched in, but it isn't. So
the thing is, like, I actually like Street Passing, and these levels probably
you can save them as your high score.
Right, but the pack that you chose, apparently, like, many people have gotten like 30,000 coins on it already, which
is
a limit.
Yeah.
And so I just expect people to start Street Passing these levels over and over again, and I'm not really looking forward to that, because currently everyone I Street Pass with is always picking the same levels. You know, they're supposed to be random, but people are focusing on, you know, the couple of levels that are very easy to get coins in, and as a result, I'm always playing the same levels.
You know, I don't know that people are deliberately focusing on. I think those are just the levels that are most successful.
It's just like, it's what comes naturally. They're like, oh, okay, I don't even have to work all that hard to get high coin scores in these levels, so I'm going to keep the score. And as a result,
I have no sympathy. You're saying that the people you Street Pass with on a day to day basis are too good at Coin Rush, or they're gaming the system. I wish I had that problem.
They are not too good. They're lazy. They're just picking.
Well, no, I don't think that's fair, because they didn't pick what levels they got. I think it just so happened that their highest scores were on random draws that were high coin levels. It makes sense.
No, there are clear levels that reward you with more coins, and just naturally, I suppose, like, it doesn't have to be premeditated, but these people, like, end up always getting the same levels, the same, it's very
right.
easy to get a high score on them. So that's the one that they save, that's the one that they Street Pass, and
sure.
Those are the levels that I keep having to play over and over again, and it's really, really getting old. I'm Street Passing a flower pack where I did not do all that great in, just because, you know, I don't want to bore people.
That's Nintendo's problem. The Coin Rush mode should not be randomly selected.
Or it should be more randomly selected.
If it weren't randomly selected, though, I would think Guillaume's problem would be more acute, because people would be able to deliberately select the highest coin levels.
Yeah, right. You could just not challenge those sets of levels that you think are too easy to cheese. You'd select the that's the problem with Coin Rush, is that you don't know which levels you're going to do, and you don't know that's the problem, right? If there were multiple packs of levels on each tier built into the game, made up of the levels that are already in there, then you could play the ones that you think are the most interesting and the most competitive, and then you would only be challenged by the people who had also done that same pack, and so then you'd be on equal footing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what you need is a way to, like, filter which ones you want even receive, basically. It ignores certain ones that you just, like, you know what, I don't want to play any you know, any challenge modes that have this level in it. I'm sick of this level.
But the problem is, like, then you're going to end up not really playing any of them. And you don't really, there's no way to know which levels are within a certain pack until you've played through it. And you don't even
because
know.
Because they're random. That's the problem.
Right, but also, like, there's no way to know what the opponent's score is until you've completed the three levels. So you don't even know if it's worth your time. Like, you might bust your ass, and then it ends up that the person only got a couple of coins throughout the whole, you know, series of three levels.
I want to street pass someone with no coins. And just screw with them.
That would be impressive.
I've actually tried that. It's impossible.
Yeah, that would be pretty impressive.
Just because I know when they played it, their reaction at the end would be, what the f-?
You know, maybe the next round of DLC will have a coin rush pack where the goal is to have the least coins possible. I mean, that would be interesting. That would be something you've never done in a Mario game.
Right, I tried to do that through the main game, but right at level 1-2, it was impossible to avoid coins, so I just gave up.
I think you might be able to pull off a level pack where you can more or less avoid them.
Yeah, probably.
Which would be very, very difficult, but certainly worth attempting just to make that my one people get. And then when they get the bonus for clearing your stage, they get a bonus of nothing, which makes it even better.
Yeah, that's really high-level play. I think that'd be cool.
It's high level play and high level trolling. It's a nice 1-2.
Well, speaking of trolling, James, maybe you should tell us about the other.
Yeah.
Game
so
you
when
played.
I was discussing last week why I picked a game that I wasn't really that interested in playing, the reason was I was moving away from a game that is deliberately trolling me in Faster Than Light into a game that wasn't. My other choice was to segue into a game that decides to actually troll worse. That game is Dark Souls. Which is basically also could be called Dark Trolls. But I don't know exactly what I'm going to say, so this may sound somewhat circuitous when I discuss the game.
Does it deal with really ugly-looking plastic dolls with black hair?
Possibly. I haven't gotten very far
dark
yet.
Dark Trolls.
So, basically, the game is set in a world where being undead is not particularly alarming to anyone in particular. It's kind of a natural state. There are lots of people who are classified as undead. They're usually shipped off to a prison in some faraway land, or they reside in a nation that is comprised of undead people. You are one such...
It sounds very George Romero.
You are one such person who is trying to restore his humanity and complete some kind of chosen person quest. So, you start out with the character you build in a very Western RPG style, which this game isn't. It's not a Western RPG at all, but it kind of is. And you get a handful of classes you can select, and then you spend forever making your face, only for the game to start out, and you're actually a zombie. So, screw the face design you just did. You're now covered in blisters. You then proceed to escape from this prison, where you have been essentially sent, by killing lots of these other undead to gain souls, which are essentially the game's currency. You then expend these souls to either buy items, buy weapon enhancements, or to level up. And leveling up in this game is a bit different. You actually just say, I want to increase this stat. So what happens is you collect a cache of souls as you kill these undead, and then you get to these places where you can essentially use them. And once you heal and level up, everything you've killed respawns. Yay! But the game starts out with you having to sort of wander through this prison until you can basically find your way to the exit, at which point you're attacked by a giant hulking monster who kills you almost instantly. Because as the game warns on the back of the box, you will die. And you will, because that's what the game does. Now, how it rewards/punishes death is kind of interesting. What happens is you're essentially sent back to the last campfire, which is essentially your checkpoints that you used, and all of your souls you've collected are gone. Now, your levels aren't damaged, nothing else is wrong, your items aren't lost. The only thing that's gone are your souls, and another thing called humanity that I'll talk about in a minute. It's really secondary. But where they are is basically they're left on the bloodstain from where you were killed last time. And you are killed many, many times. Meaning, in theory, you can go back and recollect all those souls you lost. And in fact, the very first boss of the game, at the very beginning, where the game hasn't explained to me what the hell I'm trying to do. When I finally killed him, there were a lot of bloodstains in the room he resided in, and lots of souls for me to recollect. And then I could use them, and they were essentially locked away safely once I got to use them. The game is basically this giant open world where you explore out and try not to die. Or if you do die, you have to go back and get your stuff. You see this a little bit in Zombie, as Ubisoft has called it. It is not an original concept. This is very, very prevalent in this game. It is sadistically difficult. There are insane numbers of enemies, and you start out tremendously weak. Enemies that the game rates as, quote, zero, as in they're not dangerous at all. There's still signs on the ground that warn you what's coming ahead, and these opaque riddles will annihilate you even a few hours into the game, because it's very, very hard. What I've found is that when you actually do something, so like when I found a boss and he killed me a bunch of times, and I finally killed him and collected the remains from the various bodies of mine he left in a heap, I was actually felt very, very, very happy with myself. I was excited. This is the best. Then I realized I had to make it back to a campfire to save all my stuff and died. So I had to go all the way back and get it. That's what this game does to you. It's like, you're like, yeah, I'm the best.
Did the boss stay dead?
I don't know. I didn't have to get that far. I was killed beyond as I was moving back by enemies that spawned behind me in the various times I had died. I believe the bosses do stay dead, but I'm not inclined to go look because I really just barely pulled that out.
Okay, but the important thing is you didn't really lose progress as long as you can make it back to where
right.
You died.
Now, the tricky part is making it back. I found that I have big caches of experience or souls, whatever you want to call them, somewhere way on this one end of the island that I'm on, and I've gotten lost, and it's very easy to get lost because there's no real directives going on. As I was wandering down one of the branching paths from the start area, I got pretty far, and then I got wiped out. And every time I've gone back to try to recollect the souls I lost that way, I've just added to the heap of dead bodies, my own primarily.
So does this heap of dead bodies, they exist until you have a chance to pick them up, even if you turn off the game?
As near as I can tell, yes.
Even if you die 1,000 times?
As near as I can tell, that is true. Now, thankfully, I usually make it to the last dead body and collect it so it remains in one heap, just for the sake of cleanliness. But I know there's a very big cache just beyond where I seem to be able to get to. But even if I get there, I have to get back. So it's sort of this risk-reward mechanic of, I've got a lot of souls, do I want to keep going or do I want to turn around? Knowing that if you turn around, everything you've killed to get this far comes back. It's a gamble. I mean, everything you do in this game is a gamble, and it's like playing in a casino. The dealer's going to win most of the hands. So you just sort of have to be really, really, really conservative or just really aggressive and just stick to it. You can't mix it up. You can't go aggressive and then try to be conservative on your way back because you're going to end up getting screwed. What I have found, though, is that the game's combat system, which is weird, is it's very oddly controlled. You control your right and left hands. I'm playing on the Xbox with
LB and RB.
Yeah, that one. That's how you control your hands. You lock on to targets by clicking the right thumbstick as opposed to doing a button. And you can't pause the game. So when you go into your inventory, you're still being hit by things. It's really, really freaky weird. But as I've gotten better at it, I've learned to dodge things. And finally, the only reason I beat that second boss was because I got more comfortable with the combat mechanics. I feel like the more comfortable I get with them, the better I'll get, and the game will actually start to flow more peacefully. But it is really trolly. I mean, there's an enemy right outside the start area of the game that will kill you mercilessly, much faster than the final boss of the previous area. And the game gives you no warning. You're about to walk into what would best be described as the mouth of hell. It's like, oh, I'm going to go this way, and oh, a skeleton. That's not dangerous. Oh God, I'm dead. So
this does not
you love
sound
it,
like
don't
a,
you?
Yeah, this doesn't sound like a game for me.
No, I can't imagine this is a game for many people, but its fans are passionate about it, and that's why I got it. I mean, it has a fan base that is tremendously passionate.
Do you know if the servers are still up for the game? Because the whole point, like you say, there's no indication that you're about to enter the mouth of hell, but people are supposed to leave you indications. Other people who are playing the game have played the game.
Dark Souls, yes, the servers are still up. I believe its predecessor, the servers are not still up.
Okay.
I didn't realize, though, as Guillaume has pointed out, that the notices that are all over the freaking ground are actually apparently written by users. I know that when you use the humanity you collect to restore your form back to human form, you can, quote, invade other players' worlds and try to conquer them, and they can also invade yours. I'm not sure what that means in terms of gameplay, because I'm obviously not that far yet, but could be interesting. I'm not sure. I want to stick with this game a little bit longer because I really want to see what it's like. You know, I want to try to get deeper into the game because I felt like I was banging my head against the wall for 2 days. And then I finally got through this town full of demons or this town full of the undead and actually made it to the boss. And after just pounding on him long enough, I finally got through and I felt like, okay, I get this game a little bit better. But God, am I lost.
Yeah, life's too short, in my opinion. Like, but I understand your curiosity, because I had it too. TYP, why don't you go next, please?
So, this was probably about a month ago. I think it was before the last time I was on the show, but I had an opportunity to play a Mario Party game. And I thought I'd let you guys guess which one I played.
Oh, this is torture.
DS! 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
So I'm like, at first we were going to play Mario Party 2. And, you know, my friend and I used to play Mario Party 2 a long time ago. We thought it'd be fun to play with my wife, you know, the three of us. Just, hey, you know, we got 20 minutes. We don't want to only bust out Brawl. Let's do something we can all play. So we went to Mario Party 4, the first GameCube release. And actually, we had a lot of fun with it. It's dated, and I don't know what the more recent Mario Parties are like, but, you know, the boards...
They use a microphone.
...have their quirks. The one we played, it's just so hard. You don't know where that star is going to be because they move it after someone gets it, and so it's kind of like the game trolls you. You get close to it, and then it gets moved, or, you know, someone else gets there, and you're totally on the wrong path. But what I thought was funny was that since Jenny's, my wife's not a very good gamer... She hasn't really played that much. We thought we'd give her a, I guess what do they call it, a handicap of like two extra stars at the start of the game. And boy, was that a bad idea, because I forgot just how random Mario Party is.
Everyone has a handicap in Mario Party.
So I think what we figured out that was that at the end of the game, she won by a lot, and she probably would have still won even if we hadn't given her the handicap. Just because she happened to be where the stars were and, you know, just sort of the way things fell out.
But what was the effect on her? Like as a, you know, not really a gamer person, like winning the game like that. Did she like that? Did it make her feel like, hey, you know, I really enjoy this. I could do this again.
I think she had fun. I mean, we could all tell that it was kind of like, you know, there's a bit of ass hattery going on, and it's like, oh, I'm not sure, you know, if I deserve to win. No one's ever really sure with Mario Party whether they deserve to win.
No one deserves to win Mario Party.
but I mean, the good thing about Mario Party, and I didn't appreciate it, but most of the mini games are simple enough in concept that anyone can really wrap their head around it, at least after a trial. You know, you can do a practice session. In most of the Mario Party games, or maybe all of them. So, I mean, you get it quickly. You get the minigame quickly, and a lot of them have similarities, and usually you're only worrying about one or maybe two things, like, you know, maybe you're just running around, or maybe you're just having to jump. It isn't as complex as some of these other games where you're juggling stuff. And so it's very approachable, and I think there really is a place for this kind of gaming, and it, I guess... I mean, the term casual game has morphed over the years. I guess this was a casual game when it first came out. I think it definitely is more gamey than, you know, some of the stuff that we think of as casual games now. But it's fun. I was surprised at how much fun I had with it. Definitely, you got to have human players. And I know I've been saying this for like 7 years now, but I'm still looking forward to that, you know, full featured online Mario Party game where you don't have to worry about computers ever, because they really need to make that.
I hear you. But you know, I mean, it doesn't have that, but supposedly Mario Party 9 is crazy good. So, and you know, it's on the Wii, so there's some motion control stuff to it, but apparently they got rid of a lot of the really gimmicky crap from 8, and I've heard it's just amazing. I mean, and those guys, the same guys in D-Cube, they went off and made Wii Party,
right,
and got some of the like really, really crazy stuff out of their system. But I think they maybe also learned a little bit about what that kind of game needs at its core, and then they brought that back to Mario Party and put it into that familiar formula with the characters and the worlds and everything. And the reviews, including the one on our site, were just glowing for Mario Party 9. I thought, wow, I mean, I can't even get people to play Smash Brothers, but if I had like a group of people who got together on a really regular basis to play right. video games, I would totally consider something like that. I mean, I think Mario Party's awesome. It's just been so long since I was really in a situation where it even made any kind of sense for me to own a game like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Mario Party does not make any sense with just two people. If you just have two people, I know there are some modes in some of the Mario Party games that,
yeah, it's that, a little know, boring.
Just, well, right. yeah.
It's yeah, it just is. It's just dull.
The other thing, if you've only got two people, there's more of a tendency to be competitive with each other. Whereas right. if you've got three, you can kind of be like, ah, whatever, I'm just here to have fun. But if you have two people, it's really head-to-head. And yeah. Mario Party is just so patently unfair that right. you really don't want to take it seriously as a competitive
yeah,
game.
Yeah, and the problem is if you just go head-to-head too, you might let the AI decide to make somebody the winner.
Right, which, exactly.
Which, it, is, which it is want to do. It will decide, this is Daisy's night.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Daisy, and I have all the stars.
I've played this franchise only three times. The first time was on the DS, and I was the only one who didn't know what he was doing. And that went well. Like, we actually finished the game because I wanted to learn. You know, like, I'm a gamer, and I wanted to get through that. But then I played Mario Party 8 with people oh, yeah. who had never played it.
And, I've heard that yeah, one sucks.
It's not very good. And then I played Mario Party 2 with another group of people, and we didn't finish it either. And what I find is that as simple as the games are, you still have text to read through, and there are so many yeah. different mini games, and they don't repeat very much. And over the course of a game, you can't really finish one in under half an hour. And that seems to be too long for most people when they have to stop the action and like watch someone roll a die and then read some rules and then try the mini game and then actually play it.
Yeah,
and
there are modes to help streamline that if you want. Like a lot of the games have modes where you just choose mini games or you choose a bundle of them and they kind of forego the board, you know?
Yeah, but you have to unlock them, right?
Yeah, don't the games, at least somewhat recently, have like a short mode? Like, where the game is just faster?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
You probably do. I mean, even the game version I played, I mean, you can choose how many turns it is. So we said, look, we got like 45 minutes before my buddy got to go. So, you know, we'll just do a 10-turn game.
But that does take a long time anyway.
It does.
I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. It's not a fast game.
No, it's not meant to be, though.
No, but it's a virtual board game. Board games, most board games, you can't play in less than 45 minutes either.
So right.
I think they expect that you know what you're getting into and you sit down to play Mario Party. Especially mm. after nine, really like more like 12 games in the series.
Wait, what are the others? I mean, I know.
I think there's two for DS and there's one for GBA.
I don't think there are two. Are there two for DS? I only know one.
Maybe just one.
It's actually really good. I own that game. But yeah, the DS game, you can do the full game as a download play. That would be a PAX East thing if you could like rent one out and play it on the modern console room where there isn't necessarily a time limit.
At PAX, they've got the you can basically borrow DS like portable games and bring them anywhere as long as you bring them back.
Oh yeah, there you go.
So
Mario
that
Party
works.
DS.
Yep.
It's a date.
Yeah, I should probably move on to my another game that I've been playing, and that would be Kirby Nightmare in Dream Land, which Ooh. Is the GBA port of Kirby's Adventure for the NES. I must confess, I was like, I gotta have something to talk about for the shows, and I'm like, what can I play real quick? And so I looked through my catalog and I picked out this game. It's actually the Japanese version of it, because you know Nintendo used to not have region locking on their portables, and I played the shit out of this game back. I guess it was probably my first year of undergraduate. I had 100%ed everything, which lets me unlock Meta Knight mode. And so I said, you know what, I'll play through this. And for those not familiar with this, it's basically a time attack through the entire game as Meta Knight. And so he kind of, you know, you just have a sword and it's kind of like an overpowered sword power where you can do the up stab, a down stab, I think, and one or two other moves. And it actually feels really different from most Kirby games because there's this timer that you want to get a low time. I found that I really played it a lot differently than normal. I mean, Kirby, I'm usually pretty sloppy when I play a Kirby game because the game usually lets me.
Well, because you can be.
Yeah, and that really doesn't work so well because if you're rushing through this game, you only have three hits, just like in the extra mode of Kirby's Adventure. So it's not that hard to die. And of course, if you die, then it's going to consume more time, and you aren't punished too badly. You know, if you get a game over, you'll basically have to play that entire level over again. But it adds up, and so it made it feel a little more like a Sonic game or something, where you're really trying to play quickly without screwing up.
Got to go fast.
So it actually was a very interesting contrast to Kirby and the Amazing Mirror, which is built on pretty much the same engine. I encourage it. I recommend that game, but you have to unlock that by, I think, playing through both the regular and extra mode, and getting all the secrets there. So I don't know how many people actually have played through that mode. You know, it's not something you can just pick up and play unless you've already gotten there.
It's a hard unlock.
Yeah, it's a hard unlock, but it's cool. It's a nice bonus feature that I remember really enjoying way back when, and it holds up.
Very cool.
So that's all I had.
Cool, man. Well, actually, I'm going to talk about a platformer as well, the third in the row. I've not so much this week, but just kind of cumulatively over the past month or so, I've been playing through Rayman Origins. And I've been playing it on Steam because I got a cheap copy during the summer sale, but I'm playing with a controller, so it's a pretty authentic experience, I think. And the PC version runs fine. It plays exactly like a console game if you've got a controller. And, Rayman Origins, I really hadn't played it since the E3 demo last year. Yeah, I mean, we were playing like three or four player, and it was madness. And it was like, this is impossible. Like, no one's actually going to play through the game like this, you know. But it was right after, very soon after New Super Mario Bros. Wii. And it was like, oh, cool, you know, there's going to be more games like that. The idea of a four-player simultaneous 2D platformer, you know, was fairly fresh and especially one that was clearly very challenging. You know, it was kind of an interesting idea. Flash forward now, I'm obviously not playing this multiplayer. I'm playing it on my PC of all things. I think as a solo adventure, it's very satisfying, very, very good 2D platformer. And Guillaume, I know you've played through it quite a bit as well. I'm curious to hear how far you got.
I finished the game. I didn't take the time to complete all of the time trials, but I think eventually I might get there.
Did you get all the red teeth?
Yeah. I did. And then, well, spoilers alert, there's a level that you unlock that is balls hard, but I finished that too.
Yes, it is.
So you've played it too,
man. Land of the Livid Dead.
Yeah, I talked about it on this show, I don't know, a couple months ago.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm in pretty much the same boat as Guillaume. I beat all the levels. I won't say I got all the MacGuffins or whatever they're called. But I have seen all the levels in the game.
Yeah, you guys are brave. I mean, I thought that I was...
Yeah, it's tough.
I thought I was almost finished with this game, and then I got to the... I got through, like, the four main worlds, I guess. I got all the powers. I got all of Rayman's abilities, so I can run up walls, and I can swim, and I can hover, etc. And, I at that point, I was like, you know, this was not as hard as I expected. I've really had a good time with it. It hasn't been... overly challenging, but it's been challenging enough, and it was long enough. I felt pretty good about what I'd paid for it, and had enjoyed my time with it, and I get through those worlds, and I find out, oh, actually there is twice as much content in this game as you thought there was.
Mm-hmm.
it opens up like every world that you've been to. It adds another layer of new levels to those. So now there's like four or five extra levels. In all the places you've been before. And those levels are, I played through the first world, the second version of the first world or whatever. And, I enjoyed it. I mean, it's definitely more challenging than the first set of levels. But what I do like about it is, the first part, the first half of the game as you go through it, every world is kind of centered around you using this new ability that you've gotten. And the cool right. thing about going through the second half of the game is now they know you've got all those abilities and they ask you to sort of combine them. You know, the levels are designed around you having all those and using them. And in some cases, it's optional using them or not. You kind of get a different experience if you become tiny and play through the rest of the level that way, which reminded me a lot of New Super Mario Brothers, of course, you know, having the mini mushroom. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really interesting. I don't know that I really wanted that much more content from the game. I felt like it was already kind of a good length. And at this point, I feel like it's kind of outstaying its welcome a little bit, especially for how much more difficult it is. So I don't know that I'm going to go as far as you guys did and play everything, but maybe I'll kind of go back to it every now and then and sort of play a world at a time so I don't overdose on Rayman.
I must admit, I did take a break somewhere in the middle. And I just remember thinking, like, wow, this game will never end.
Yeah.
I plowed through it, but I feel like the final two worlds, including the one that you have to unlock, it's just so cynical. The game gets so cynical, and it starts to run into the limitations of its own physics engine. And so I already talked about this before. But basically, it gets to a point where you keep dying. You're not really sure why you're dying. Sometimes the timing, maybe you were very slightly off. Sometimes it just seems like something kooky just happened.
Yeah, there's just enough slop in the controls and in the physics that sometimes when things go awry, you're not really sure what went wrong. And that's a problem in a 2D platform, especially one that's so difficult as this. Even in the first half of the game, there are these race worlds that you unlock that are... It's not like you're automatically running, but the stage auto-scrolls, so you just have to hold down the shoulder button and just be running through the entire thing. And it becomes this, it's basically just timing. It's a little bit like Bit Trip Runner. You know, the music is really crazy, and you're just, the whole goal is just jump at the right second. That's all you have to do is jump at the right second. But you have to do that about 200 times consecutively without making any mistakes, or you have to go all the way back to the beginning. And it is infuriating. I mean, these levels, they're glorious to look at. Like, to watch someone play through this is amazing, but to actually be in control of it is absolutely frustrating because you have to be so precise, and the game isn't built for precision. And when something goes wrong, you're just like, fuck me, I don't know what happened. Now I have to play it all over again, and it's really, really frustrating. And this is something that a game like Bit Trip Runner avoids because it is so exact. By design, that game is so accurate. When you mess up, you know what you messed up, and you might complain that, wow, this is requiring me to be so perfect in everything I do. But you also know that the game it gives you the tools to be perfect, and it's just up to you to live up to that and to use them. And Rayman, and so I think that it's absolutely a wonderful value. It definitely lives up to being a full price game, not just in terms of number of stages, but also just the care that goes into it. But it's not a Nintendo game, and
no,
you really feel that the more you play it, the more you feel the lack of polish that someone like Miyamoto brings to a 2D platformer that other developers try to emulate and don't always succeed. That's what I'll say about it. And I think it's pertinent with the Wii U game, Rayman Legends, coming out probably at the end of this year or early next year from Ubisoft. I thought that was really impressive at E3, but I have a number of concerns about it based on my experience with this game.
Right, but the E3 demo for Rayman Legends was pretty interesting because the first time I went through that auto-scrolling level that's also a rhythm game for the person with a tablet, I did pretty well. And then the second time, maybe it was because I was being filmed, but I actually think that because I didn't hear the music as well, as much as the first time that I played, I was doing worse at the platforming. Like, it becomes a rhythm game, not just for a person with a tablet, but also, like, the musical cues are also helping you with the platforming.
Right.
So, and I think that there might be a little bit of that in the original, with Rayman Origins.
Yeah, there is near the end a little bit. I don't think it's as crisp as it was in E3.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm just saying, like, the sloppy physics and controls are back for the sequel, as far as I can tell. but it might also help, you know, to pay attention a little bit more to the sounds.
Guillaume's full of positivity over here.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful for it as well, because I think Rayman Origins shows a ton of promise. It's a really interesting 2D platformer, and if you're a fan of the genre, you should absolutely play it. But it's not perfect. I mean, I do have issues with it, and I think a sequel is always an opportunity to improve upon those things. So, you know, I am very hopeful for the second game, and I think it's probably something I'm going to want to pick up anyway, just to see all the crazy shit that they throw into it, because the game is really wacky and just a lot of fun to look at.
Having not had the chance to play it, it does seem like it's a much more interesting game than the first, at least for me. Like, I'm much more interested in this game than I ever was in its predecessor.
Hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I think the co-op stuff definitely adds a layer of complexity and newness, you know, originality that the first one didn't have. So very interested in that, and it's nice that people are actually working together, whereas in the first game, the multiplayer is
just a snap
very
fight.
Contrary to making progress.
Yes.
You really can't imagine anyone beating Rayman Origins in multiplayer. I don't even know that it's possible.
You can't imagine them beating Rayman with snaps over and over again.
Yes.
Until it just got bored.
Yeah. We could barely clear a screen at E3, much less the final level or the game. But yeah, I mean, you can get Rayman Origins for like next to nothing now.
I got the Wii version at launch for $30. I don't think many people paid full price for this game at all.
Right. Right. Yeah, but if you have an HD system or a nice computer, I would recommend playing it in HD because the game is all about the artwork. And I know the Wii version looks good, but I think you should play it in the best fidelity that you can.
It just can't be as sharp.
It's not just that it can't be as sharp. It doesn't look as good as games made for SD, like Donkey Kong Country Returns, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. They're scaling it down from a different version. The 3DS version, I think, is finally coming out this fall. Based on the demo, I mean, I think we probably all tried that demo and were pretty disgusted with it. So, but it's been long enough now that I wonder if they kind of went back to the drawing board and said, we need to do a little more work on this based on the reactions to the demo. And maybe that's why it's still not out. It just looked and controlled really poorly.
Yeah, there was a lag on the controls or something. It was weird.
You know, I hope that they are taking the time to actually try to make the 3DS version worthy, because it's a good game to begin with. I wouldn't want that to be a bad port, but I guess we'll find out when the reviews hit. So that's all from me, and Guillaume is going to wrap up new business.
Well, combo breaker here. I have not played a 2D platformer, but...
Get out.
Sorry. But I have played... How do you pronounce this? Quarth?
Quarth?
Quarth.
Sure.
Yeah, who came up with that? I've been... That's the game that released on the eShop, the virtual console game that released on the eShop last week. And it's one that I have kind of fond memories of. I had never played the Game Boy version, but I did play the NES version in a, like, 301, you know, pirate cartridge.
Oh no, the Mega Mixes.
And it was not as full-featured as the Game Boy game is, but that's not to say that there's a lot of features to the Game Boy game. But I remember, like, really enjoying the premise, which is that it's sort of a mix between a vertical shooter and a puzzle game. And back then, you know, like today, we've got like shooters that rhythm games that look like shooters, or, you know, all sorts of genre mashups. But back then, it was a little bit more exciting, you know, like it was really novel to see experiments like that. But we're not 15 years ago. So today, it takes a little bit more for a game to be interesting.
Actually, this is from 1990.
Wow.
22 years ago.
How dare you remind me of how old I am. But I remember looking at pictures of this game a lot, because I must have had like some sort of pamphlet from like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where they had all sorts of Ultra games featured on there. Yeah, I know. Like Super C and probably Castlevania the Adventure and Quarth. But yeah, so I've played that a little bit, and it holds up. But mostly, like, if I were to rate it for NWR, I would say, like, it's recommended for fans. Because it's really, there's nothing really to it. You are controlling this ship at the bottom of the screen, and these shapes are coming at you from the top. And you have to complete rectangles to eliminate the shapes. And these shapes might be all in a bundle. And all you have to do, really, like, if you can manage to make one single rectangle with several of those shapes, you do combos and you get power-ups, and you get more points.
How do you make the rectangles? I'm a little confused.
Yeah, I'm watching a video of this, and it's bizarre. I mean, this is hard to explain, Guillaume. You're doing a pretty good job, actually.
It is. But yeah, like, you might have, like, these kind of Tetris-looking shapes coming from the top of the screen, mm-hmm. and you shoot a one-by-one square, you okay. know, at a time. And so you fill up these L shapes to make full rectangles out of them. Or if, like, you've got several shapes that you can make one big rectangle out of, like, you only have to have the sides of the rectangle. It doesn't have to be full. So if you can just, like, complete the sides, then, you know, like, you create a rectangle, it will fill up, it will give you a multiplier, and yeah, like, more points. And I guess the strategy comes into play when you've got several shapes that are kind of in the way of a big combo-making bundle of shapes. And so you have to be quick and identify, okay, which shapes do I have to take out to be able to make a big, you know, big scoring rectangle.
So are you destroying blocks, creating blocks with your shots, coloring blocks that exist?
You're going towards them. Towards the blocks, and if they reach your level, the level of your ship, you're going to be destroyed. So you take them out by filling them up. You know, once you fill them up and make a full rectangle out of them, they disappear, okay. and you can go on. So yeah, that's Quarth. I don't know. Look at videos and look, yeah. you know, see if it interests you or not. I can't say that it's really an amazing title, but I do have fond memories of it, and I happen to have the money on my 3DS, so
it's definitely unique. I'll throw in yep. a link to a gameplay video in the show notes so people can see what the hell Quarth is, because yeah, it defies explanation to some extent.
So I decided, okay, you know what? Like, I did a pretty good job getting rid of most of my eShop backlog on my 3DS. I'm going to put it aside for a second, and I'm going to, you know, stop neglecting so much my PSP Go. And with John gone for temporarily, someone has to fill up the PSP void.
That's what Sony said.
Yeah. So I decided to start playing this game that I got again for free through PSN Plus. Final Fantasy V.
Wait, they were giving away a Final Fantasy game for no extra charge?
Well, there is a catch, it turns out. But more on that later. the game is pretty good, but I've only played through maybe like the first 3 hours. Right away, it's very, very clear that you're not going to see the most interesting characters that you've ever seen in the Final Fantasy game. You've basically got the damsel in distress, the princess, turns out. Lots of cliches. She stumbles upon this adventurer, and there's this old guy, and at some point they meet up with a pirate, and there you go. You've got your party.
Yar.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of yars in the translation. It's awful. I cannot stand accents being done that way, like in written form. It's so annoying.
I think they redid the translation for the advanced version.
They absolutely did. I remember reviews saying, wow, the game is so much more enjoyable.
Yeah, I wish I could get a copy of that, man.
Me too. But yeah, so I couldn't get into what is, you know, the meat and potatoes of the game, which is the class system. You know, like, you get different jobs, and supposedly it's an evolution of Final Fantasy III that we've, you know, some of us have played on the DS, the remake. And so it pushes that system further, and supposedly it gets really, really interesting. But I could not get into that too much. Because it turns out I you know, learned some facts about the game that made me delete it from my PSP and made me think, like, wow, I'm probably never going to play this again unless I can find a good but cheap version of this somewhere else. Because it turns out that this version of the game glitches. And that's always been true of the CD version since the PlayStation 2 came out. Like, the game played originally well on the PS1, but then on the PS2 you got those graphical glitches that sometimes when you went in the menu, in the save menu in particular, the graphics become all jumbled, and you can't really see what you're doing. Now, you can figure out, you know, what you're doing. Like, if you learn by heart, okay, so I just have to, you know, press X once and then press down once and press X again and I've saved, then, you know, you can get through that.
I don't see the problem.
Okay, it's not It's not completely...
This sounds like NES when the graphics start to glitch on you.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they are.
Right. So you can do that. You can learn by heart what you're supposed to do, or you can exit and enter the menu a couple of times, and sometimes, you know, the graphics will correct themselves somehow. But on the PS3, or on the PSP rather, there's the extra effect of perhaps like the game will just freeze on you while you're saving.
Ooh.
And that means losing all your progress. And that's something I just can't stand. But what really boggles my mind is that this version is being sold. Like, I got it for free, but if you pay for it, if you paid $10 for it, I think it is, that's what you're gonna get. It's not gonna work well on your PSP. I don't think it's gonna work well on your PS3 either.
Or your Vita, now that it plays those.
Right. So I think it's, you know, really a dick move. And, supposedly if you, I found several threads, about the problem and people just being like, wow, this is disgusting. But supposedly if you call Sony for help, they will refer you to Square Enix, and
of course they will.
Their helpline is not toll free.
What?
Yep.
That's
funny. Oh my
That's
god.
Awesome. The audacity of it is tremendous.
Wow. Hey, Gil, do you want me to like swing by Square Enix after work one day and give them peace of your mind? Because their building is fairly close to where I work. You can see it from LAX.
It's a big building. It might be hard to find the person to yell at.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, like so I decided to quit, you know, before I got too far into the game. And it's just unfortunate. And, you know,
at least you didn't pay for it.
Right. I don't want to be, you know, too much of a Nintendo apologist. And, you know, like we've discussed how disappointing it is that we're not going to be able to play VC games on the Wii U tablet or things like that.
But this wouldn't fly with Nintendo.
No, like at least they kind of make sure that what you pay for is going to work. I mean, there are problems. I did ask on Twitter if like there were VC games that had emulation problems, and some of them do, but none of them have like this just game destroying glitch.
Yeah, the closest thing I can think of in recent history would be like that weird glitch in the Skyward Sword. Zelda's Skyward Sword, where if you do certain things out of order, you can screw yourself up.
Right. Nintendo is not above reproach, but I mean... Yeah.
But they fixed it.
They fixed it, yeah.
Eventually. They fixed it in a roundabout way, yeah.
Yep. Like, this is basically a glitch that everyone who ever plays this game on the systems that they downloaded on will have at some point. Like, there's a big risk.
Right, yeah. That Zelda glitch was a... Clearly, the bug testers should have caught that bug. It isn't that strange of a thing to do.
No, and
in fact, that order. But it's still, you can play through the whole game and not see that if you just happen to. This sounds like a bug where you're going to encounter it. Like, shame on someone for not doing any testing on this game. They must have just assumed, well, you know, I'll port and the port will work and whatever.
That sucks.
Or maybe someone made some tweaks near the end of the development and they didn't bother to test it again. Who knows? But
Sony has been kind of shooting themselves in the foot with having so many different iterations of their hardware. Because it's not the first time I've had problems with a PS1 classic. I played through Spyro, the first one. I started playing it on the PS3 and it had slowdown. Like the music was all garbled. It felt like playing a game in like 50 hertz. You know, on the PAL TV set, and it was just unenjoyable. And then I transferred the game to my PSP, and everything was fine. Nintendo does do some things right, I suppose. And to the people...
virtual console games work perfectly, but they've done a good job, and they've actually patched a few virtual console games to fix things like that.
Yeah.
They don't all work perfectly, but they all work.
Yeah. Right. I would tell Vita owners who were like so mad that, you know, Sony didn't approve immediately all of the PS1 classics to be downloaded on the Vita, you know, like, just be patient. Like, if they're actually waiting on them, that perhaps means that they're testing them so that you're not buying something that won't work. So, you know, they're probably saving you some time.
I mean, this is what we told people who wrote us complaining about the tablet on the Wii U. It's like, there's a good reason for this.
Exactly. Yeah. This is why virtual console why Wii mode exists for Wii U.
Right.
Yep.
It's just too hard to...
No, it's not too hard. It's hard. It's not too hard to be worth doing.
It would be too hard by launch time to test every single Wii game.
Okay. I'm with you there.
It just would be.
I think it is worth the effort, and I hope they will make that effort. But, guys, I have excellent news. I just checked eBay, and Final Fantasy V Advance is not nearly as hard to get as I thought. The going rate is around $20, and there's lots of copies.
It used to be very difficult. I'm surprised it's gotten easier.
I thought all those Final Fantasy Advance games were pretty, you know, 4, 5, and 6 were all pretty rare. Because 6 was like, I think 6 is actually more rare. But 5 is apparently not that hard to find. And this is one of the only Final Fantasies I've never played. So this might come up in a couple months on New Business.
Yeah, I seem to recall 6 being just dumb, just how rare it was.
Yeah, Final Fantasy 6 Advance came out in like 2006. This has come up before, but it's like a super late GBA game, and they made very few copies of it. So
yes,
it's probably less valuable now that game's on virtual console, I would bet.
All right, and then they released a DS Final Fantasy in rapid succession.
Yeah, but Final Fantasy V will never come out on virtual console because it was never released in English for Super Nintendo. So, guys, let's wrap up New Business and take a break. When we come back, we're going to do Retroactive with Kirby and the Amazing Mirror.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week, we have a review of La Mulana for WiiWare by James Dawson. La Mulana is a retro-style action platform game where you play as a ninja archaeologist. We spoke about it recently, and James likes it, but finds archaeology jutsu to be difficult, to a fault. We also have a review of Cave Story for the 3DS eShop by Neil. It's another handheld Cave Story? Heck, another 3DS Cave Story? Indeed it is, and apparently this is the best, most content-filled Cave Story to date. Hope you didn't shell out for Cave Story 3D.
Ooh. Well, we also have impressions of Paper Mario Sticker Star by Aaron Kaluska. Aaron has incredibly detailed impressions based on his extended play session of Paper Mario and comes away very impressed. So if you didn't get enough information out of Billy when he was on, check that out. We also have a feature, Best of the Wii. We finally finished the ongoing Best of Wii feature, and guess the best Wii game. No, not Mad Dog McCree. It's Super Mario Galaxy. Apparently our staff didn't play 2 either. Wait, what?
It was just a little farther down the list.
It was a joke about 2 having terrible sales.
We have impressions. Bravely Default Flying Fairy for 3DS by Danny Bivens. Did Square Enix release yet another demo for Bravely Default on the Japanese eShop? You bet they did. This demo includes maps and Street Pass. How very Japanese. We also have a preview, Disney Princess for the Wii. My Fairy Tale Adventure by Carmine. I'm serious. If you ever wanted to be a fairy godmother, well, this might just be your game. And if you didn't, well, you lie.
I'm guessing Carmine wasn't so much assigned this preview as he volunteered for it. He has interesting taste in Wii games. So next up, we have a blog called Dead or Alive 5 Unboxing by who else? Zach Miller. Zach bought the collector's edition, of course he did, of Dead or Alive 5 and decided to do an unboxing blog post. This isn't an advertisement, it's more like a warning.
Boobies.
And finally, we have another blog called Denpa Men. They came by wave unboxing. Tyler Olu. Yes, he posted an unboxing video for an eShop game. And of all the games, he picked this one. I'm not even sure who he's trolling here. This is must-see TV, people.
It's the strangest thing on the site.
It's really weird. Go check it out, along with all this other great, varying greatness content over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It's time for Retroactive. We've been waiting weeks to get to this one, and boy, I'm just thrilled to jump into this. So this is Retroactive number 24, and the game we're discussing is, of course, Kirby and the Amazing Mirror. It's a GBA game. I believe it was the first GBA Kirby game. This was after Nightmare in Dreamland.
Yeah, this is the first original GBA game. It might have been the only original GBA Kirby game.
I think so, because the same developer Flagship made Kirby Squeak Squad, but that was for DS, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Flagship, I think it's worth mentioning, the crew that made this was a studio within Capcom, and they worked with Nintendo on a number of handheld games. So they made the Zelda Oracles games for Game Boy Color, of course, back around 2001? Yeah, 2001.
Yeah,
those came out the same day as GBA. And they also made Minish Cap for GBA, which ambassadors should also check out if they haven't already. It's a very good game. And they, in addition to Squeak Squad, they also worked on a couple of well-known Resident Evil games. They did Resident Evil Zero, which is not very good. And then they also did Code Veronica, which is more highly thought of. I've never played it. And Flagship doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. The guy in charge of it, Okamoto, went on to other things. Kind of under the radar. But anyway, interesting person. And for my money, Kirby and the Amazing Mirror is actually probably my favorite game that they've made, even over the handheld Zelda stuff that they did.
Same here.
To me, it redeems a franchise in that it does something with Kirby that I always wanted Kirby to do, which is to take this really intriguing ability to copy powers from enemies, and it actually gives you something to do with those powers that is interesting and that makes you approach the game with a little bit of care and thought, and it makes you care about which power you have, and it's not just jumping from one overpowered ability to the next so you can mow down enemies who present no challenge whatsoever. It does a lot more than just that, but to me that's the crowning achievement of it, is that it does sort of turned the Kirby copyability paradigm into something that I felt had more depth than any of the other Kirby games. And this really approaches what I always wanted Kirby to be when I first played it.
Okay. I'm not going to disagree with you that this game does that, but I'm going to disagree with you in the fact that there actually are other Kirby games that do attempt to leverage the power system that way. Maybe to a lesser degree, but even in Kirby's Adventure,
I don't think they're as successful as Amazing Mirror.
In Kirby's Adventure, there are a couple of places where you gotta, like, say, get a hammer power and survive using that, you know, through most of the level to be able to unlock a secret area.
Yeah, you're totally right. You're totally right. But this game is, the whole game is built around doing that kind of thing. That's the difference for me.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, Kirby Superstar does it some in the Great Cave Offensive, which was probably the inspiration for this whole game. And I think if you're a fan of Kirby Superstar, you should definitely play this. Because Cave Offensive is probably the most people's favorite part of Superstar, I would imagine. It's the biggest part. And an Amazing Mirror is kind of this giant expanded version of it. I mean, it's more challenging and it's maybe more confusing in some ways, but it is definitely more of that and takes it sort of to the next level. And for me, that's kind of the reason I never played Superstar when it first came out. I didn't play it until the DS version, which of course I played after Amazing Mirror. So for me, going back to that, it's like, oh, this is kind of not as good as what I've already played on the GBA. But I appreciate the heritage, and it, you know, Amazing Mirror wouldn't exist without Superstar. But you know, I reviewed this game when it first came out, and I've had plenty of chances to talk about it and say what I like about it. So I'm very curious to hear from you guys. And Mike, I know you've played it before. Going back to it now, if you had much time to do so, where do you feel like it fits in with the franchise, and what does it do that you like and don't like?
I did get a chance to play through most of the game. I kind of pounded through it. I'd actually been playing a little bit of it before it was even announced as a retroactive game. But I found that at first, I felt like I was sort of aimlessly wandering through just corridors, just sort of an attempt to map out a little bit of this. And, you know, there was a little bit of a, am I going the right way? Am I not going the right way? But I reached a certain point, maybe, I don't know, 1.5 hours in, 2 hours in, where all of a sudden I started finding the maps, started actually killing some of the bosses. And it's sort of like, I don't want to say it felt like dominoes, but I felt like I built momentum, and it felt like it was a more rewarding experience. I mean, I definitely like how it uses the powers. You know, you gotta have sword or maybe cutter to cut some of the platforms with strings so you can move down. And, you know, of course there are things where you have to use fire to do a, you know, launch a cannon or whatever. And there's, those are aspects that have been in Kirby games before. You are correct that they are used with more care in this game. I do find the map system to be very frustrating, and I'm actually kind of hit a wall right now where I just can't figure out how to enter one of the worlds that are left. Or I was able to enter one part of the world, but clearly it's not the right section. So I can't find where on the map there are any other entrances. Maybe it's the other entrances on the one map or the one level that I don't have a map for other than that one. So I feel like I'm at kind of an impasse, and that's kind of frustrating when you, like, I don't think I have any more places I can go, and yet I don't know how to progress. Yeah, and that's kind of frustrating.
Yeah, the map system, maybe there's a connection here. It's a Capcom game. The map system reminds me a lot of Mega Man ZX, the map system in there. Have you guys played that at all? Because it's the same kind of, okay, we're going to show you.
I may or may not have played that game.
Yes, yes. Johnny may have some experience with that game. He doesn't remember. However, I do remember playing that game, and hearing that the map system bears something in common to that.
These rooms are connected, but there is no sense of place or anything. It's not like, you know, in a Metroid game where, you know, the rooms fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. It's just sort of an arbitrary, this like mini universe connects to this other mini universe through this door.
Yeah, it shows you all the connections, but it doesn't tell you exactly where on a screen you are or where on a screen those exits are.
So, you know, it's fun. The map itself is kind of funny because when I first was playing the game, this is my first time playing it, and I think it was like a week after we announced what this game was going to be. I basically was bitching during the non-recording segment that I'm just lost all the time. And Johnny points out, well, there's a map. And I'm like, wait, what?
We heard from people in the forum thread who played through the entire game the first time, not even knowing there was a map.
Well, you know, it's not exactly something they advertise. Hey, there's a map here.
Right. Yeah, you got to like push L or R or select or something.
Like you have to do hand voodoo to make it show up. It's incredibly obtuse, but once you get to it, it's like, oh, wow, this would have been helpful sometime in the past.
Yeah.
But it does tell you, no, like when you press start, then it says like you see like map, press select, doesn't it?
You are right. They do tell you, but it's not over.
It's not immediately obvious.
It's not immediately obvious.
And it's something that seems so important to the game, it probably should have been pointed out at the very beginning. But really the game, when you start the game, it just goes, go. And that's basically how it runs.
Yeah, it should be the default pause screen.
Yeah that would be be good.
Yeah, very simple fix. Very, very simple. I mean, but the map is, a very controversial element of the game, and rightly so, because when you first start, every section, there's 9 areas of the game. They're all pretty big, and each one has its own map screen. And when you first enter there, you haven't collected the actual map treasure, which is in one of the giant treasure chests that you may or may not come across as you explore the worlds. And until you get that, the map is extremely zoomed out, and you don't see the connecting paths between rooms. You just see that there are these rooms, and they're kind of scattered. But I think Guillaume made an excellent point in that there's no concrete physical connection from room to room, because you're literally just – you're always warping from one room to another with these doorways. Yeah. And so it you can't look at those maps and have any sense of how one thing connects to another. Until you find that map treasure, you're really kind of playing in the dark, even if you have found the map screen.
And I've gone through whole areas and not found that map treasure. Right. I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah. You could beat the boss, you could explore every room and not find it.
Yeah.
Because they're really hidden.
Yeah, it seems like the ultimate dick move. All right, we're going to make this really convoluted, but we're going to hide the map like they're freaking uranium.
In certain worlds, like they have so many doors, it feels like, okay, you enter a room, you've got two or three doors, you enter one of those rooms, then you've got two or three doors. There's so many permutations, and at some point you just lose track, and it's just extremely daunting.
And those doors may not take you anywhere in particular. I mean... No.
If it showed you the connections as you discovered the rooms, I think that that would have resolved a lot of our confusion and complaints.
Yeah. Like Zelda does. I mean, like when you go into a Zelda dungeon, even if you haven't found the map treasure, it still maps out where you've been. So you can at least know if you're backtracking over your previous, you know, steps. And then when you get the map treasure, that shows everything. It shows you the outline of the dungeon. So it shows you where you've been, but also where you haven't been yet. And I think that would have been a really nice touch. And Metroid does the same thing. When you find a map room and you download that data, it doesn't tell you what's in every room. It doesn't even show you every room. There's still secrets, but it shows you the outline of the area, and it gives you an idea of what direction you might want to kind of branch out into. And I think this is a completely valid criticism of Amazing Mirror. But I think it's something you can overcome as you play.
Well, you almost have no choice to overcome it as you play more, because it kind of works as a process of elimination. You know, you keep going through the doors that you haven't been in before. And, you know, little by little, you end up exploring everything. But yeah, like, it's not like, okay, you are sent in a certain direction and then you can go. It's more like, okay, well, I haven't been there before, so I should go there. It's kind of the opposite of the way that you normally explore in other games, I find.
Am I the only one who finds like the numbering for the worlds to be thoroughly arbitrary? I mean, I think the first boss I actually killed, or maybe the second one, was in World 9. And right, I think this is the exact same thing that happened to me last time when I played through this game.
I think mine was like 5. It's just because that's the first boss I stumbled across.
Right.
Right. The game is nonlinear to a fault. It's not that you can do anything in any order, but from the very beginning of the game, there's probably at least a dozen ways you could branch off and do something productive and important to the overall end of the game. And there's not really a correct way to play through it. I don't think there's an optimal path, really. Because there's not that much persistence. It's not like you need to go and achieve something that then allows you to go to World 7. I mean, there are these pink switches that create permanent waypoints that are very important. But you don't even have to activate those pink switches to get anywhere. They're just for your convenience. They let you get back to places easily. But you could play through the game without ever hitting those. So you really can do play through the game in virtually any sequence, and that is overwhelming.
Mm. Yeah. But going back to what we were saying at the beginning about the structure of the game and how it leverages Kirby's powers in a new way, I got to say that this format for a game, for a Kirby game, really makes a lot of sense, because one of the complaints that people have about them is that the platforming is kind of inconsequential. You can always blow yourself up and start hovering over a level, and pits and other hazards can be easily avoided. But then when you think of, you know, the Metroid-ish Castlevania games, the platforming is also pretty inconsequential. You know, unlike the previous Castlevanias, you don't really have bottomless pits. You know, you don't really have intense platforming. It's more about taking out the enemies in a certain, you know, from room to room and to explore. So it just, you know, like it just feels like Kirby is well suited already for this type of design.
Yeah, and you, I think you playing this, you can see the good intentions that spawn something very broken like Subspace Emissary. Because the concept of that mode in Smash Brothers Brawl is that you have this non-linear, interconnected world with a lot of different goals to achieve, and it's possible to play through that entire mode with one of 40 different characters.
Right.
So the platforming by its nature has to be more or less inconsequential because you have these characters who all have different abilities and you have to design something generic enough that any of them can find a way to get through it. And that's very much the way Kirby games are made. It's no coincidence that these series come from the same mind, you know. But whereas I think Subspace Emissary is so generic and it does have some of the same problems as Amazing Mirror, but it's not nearly as tightly designed because it isn't based around these copy powers that you have to pick up from the environment. And so it feels like you're just kind of grinding through it with no real sense of purpose, except I want to unlock the thing at the end of the tunnel. And Amazing Mirror, I think, feels much more like there's something going on here. There's an environmental puzzle. I have to figure out how to get from here to here. And the way that you figure that out, the way you solve those puzzles is interesting and satisfying, and in some cases quite challenging, I think.
Yeah, I don't think that the puzzles are necessarily like more plentiful than in other Kirby games, but there are some really quality ones there, and one of my favorites was you had to pick up the mini power-up to go through an opening, and then you had to let yourself be caught by this enemy that steals your power for himself, and then you had to do something else that you can only do when you're big, and then you had to take the mini power back from him.
You do realize you can push select to drop your power, right?
You can, but you won't have enough time to move the block before the star disappears.
Right. That's what and you needed the maybe we're not talking about the same part, because there's a couple of puzzles that are kind of similar and that require a mini power-up. But yeah, if you pick up another power-up, whatever power-up is just bouncing around on the stage will disappear. And I think you had to pick something else for that particular puzzle. So like that was pretty rewarding.
There's a pertinent forum post here from Pixelated Pixies alliteration and said the choice of which power-up to use in a given Kirby level is usually a stylistic one. Mm-hmm. Rarely is it a tactical one. But this game makes some improvement in that regard. But I still think the game could have gone further in giving the various power-ups more utility. There are few, if any, situations that have come across, for example, that were not overcome by using Fighter, Hammer, or Fire. And that's true. I mean, there's no doubt that certain abilities in the game have a broader utility than others, but I think there are things put in the game to take advantage of every power in the game except sleep, which is kind of not even a power, it's kind of a troll. But I think this game puts you in situations where you have to use powers like laser and sword and bomb and rock and things that you normally wouldn't think of. Maybe laser from Kirby's Adventure, because you do have to reflected off some things in that game. Mm-hmm. But some of these powers have been with Kirby for a really long time, and they've never really been used in a puzzly way. And I think Amazing Mirror, it doesn't go far enough maybe, but I think it makes at least a token effort to make it feel like even these really familiar powers can be used for something clever that you've never done before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. James, haven't heard as much from you in a general sense. I mean, I don't know how far you got into the game.
So,
but
I mean, I got through three or four of the mirror shards. So, not as far as everybody else here. I don't know. For me, I just felt like a lot of times I would come to places where I didn't have the right power, just like was being mentioned here. And the game doesn't necessarily give it to you in the relative area you need it either. It did take me a little while to figure out how to get rid of my powers, though, which was kind of annoying. But so even if the power was there I wanted, it's like, well, I guess I have to get hit to get rid of it. No. But I don't know. I just, you know, I like Kirby games a lot. And for whatever reason, this one just doesn't quite do it for me the same way the rest of them do. I don't know. It may be that the higher emphasis on the world exploration just isn't my cup of tea or what I expected from one of these games.
Yeah, you're not a fan of backtracking or exploration for the sake of exploration, right?
Well, I'm not for the sake of exploration, that's fine. It's more exploration for the sake, or backtracking exploration for the sake of progressing.
Hmm.
That bothers me more than anything.
I mean, there's definitely a fair bit of that in this game.
Yeah,
there's a Metroid element to Amazing Mirror, even though it's not overly Metroid-y, but for one thing, it's a lot looser. It's more open than a Metroid game is. It's more non-linear, but there are some aspects of it that I could see wouldn't sit as well with you, James.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for me, the ultimate Kirby game is Nightmare in Dreamland. I mean, for me, that game is awesome. I really enjoy, what was the one that got remade on the DS? The Super Nintendo version of that.
Kirby Superstar Ultra?
Yeah, so Kirby Superstar. I haven't played the DS remake.
Right.
But, I mean, that Super Nintendo game was really great for me. You know, I liked the quick action. I liked the variety of gameplay modes. For this, I don't know, it felt more straightforward. I think if I had the multiplayer component going, it would probably be more enjoyable. But for me, all I had was Kirby and his stupid cell phone calling the other Kirby to stand around and do nothing effective whatsoever.
The multiple Kirbys are weird because for puzzle solving, they're frustrating and stupid and not very useful. But if you get into like one of the boss fights, they're almost overpowered.
Yeah,
I almost feel
agree.
Guilty calling them in sometimes.
So, you know, I had that situation in one boss fight, but then in another boss fight that immediately followed it, I found them to be dumb. I mean, that's the best way. But they would stand. So, I'm trying to remember what the boss's name is. He's the one that shoots down lightning. He's the cloud.
Krakos.
Yeah. They basically just stood there and allowed him to electrocute them to death.
Yep. Yep. That's what I have in mind too.
It's like, what are you doing? Do something. Like they would get shocked and they'd run around for a little bit, then they get shocked again. I'm like, God.
Well, at least they heal you when they warp in.
Yeah, they come. One of them comes in and makes out with you, and then you get healed.
Uh-huh. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
That's kind of what it looks like. It's a little weird animation.
Sometimes they drop Maxim tomatoes and stuff like that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But the one of the biggest exploits that you can do with them is I was fighting the final boss actually, and I summoned them, and then took out a chunk of the boss's health, and then died. But one of them lived. So when I was revived, the boss's health didn't go back up. You know, I didn't start over.
Ooh.
So wait, nice. was he just dicking around in the level while you revived?
I assume so. Yeah.
I just like to imagine he's walking back and forth on the bottom of the screen the whole time you're gone.
Yeah, like think about it. Like if I had been playing this multiplayer, I guess that would have meant one player was not dead yet. And so I just was brought back to life to assist him, except that him was the computer.
That's so weird. I mean, I didn't even think about like the persistence aspect of this game. I mean, I see that, you know, they ostensibly wander around, you know, and in theory they are in these other rooms. I don't know if the game is kind of simulating
they
that.
They can be in other worlds, actually.
Yeah.
So, like, I'll go back to the main room, and I'll see, like, one or two of them are just hanging out around the mirror, just floating around like idiots.
Oh, like I don't know if you guys ever had a similar experience, but one time I was playing through a level in the game, and this pink UFO thing came up, and I thought it was an enemy, and I couldn't kill it. Like it was just hovering around me. I couldn't suction it. I couldn't kill it with any other powers. I was like, what the hell? And then I finally realized, I looked up at the top at the little sort of position indicator, and I realized it's one of my other Kirby dudes. But when they get UFO, they don't really look like Kirby anymore.
Right.
No, UFO, the exact same thing happened to me. I was sure that was an enemy, and I was just like, what the hell?
I did have an instance where there were two Kirbys, myself and another one, in the UFO, and we were just flying around, and it was the dumbest thing I've ever seen, because he just goes headfirst into battle. I'm like, no, get back here, we can shoot everything! God, I hate you!
Yeah, UFO is super powerful and like, crazy useful, but it's very rare, and it's so great that it makes me want to play really conservatively whenever I get it.
Yeah. Well, I think that was the intent. I mean, back when it was introduced in Kirby's Adventure, they actually took it away from you after you beat the level because they knew it was so powerful.
Yeah, in this game, I mean, it is still super useful and super powerful, but there's just... That's one thing I felt about this game is even just the platforming, the combat, the way that enemies attack you is so much more aggressive in this game than in other Kirby games. I think even if you have a really, really great power, it's hard to hang on to it.
It is.
Because enemies will just... like the little yellow guys that jump up and down, they can jump pretty much the entire height of the screen.
Oh, yeah. They're bastards. I mean, they're everywhere.
The blue guys that roll around, if you get into like a narrow area with those guys, they're almost impossible to avoid. You've got guys flying around and shooting lasers at you from practically off the screen. And the levels are so big that sometimes you're like scrolling in multiple directions at once. And it's really hard to see things coming sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've had issues where some of the bosses just, or not bosses, some of the enemies just seem to spawn in a situation where they're given an inordinate advantage. And, I mean, they were put there, and so there's not much you can do about it. But there's, like, one hall where there's a cutter, and he basically is sitting in a narrow hallway where you have nowhere to jump. He's just heaving his helmet at you down the hall. It's like, well, he's going to hit me, and there's nothing I can do about it. So, I basically just like, all right, just hit me and then I'll bum rush you and we'll just deal with it from there.
So, GLaDOS posted in the forums, I was trying to beat the eyeball cloud boss, Krakko, and I realized something. I was actually being precise and careful in a Kirby platformer. I played around 4 of these and every one of them is extremely easy. I just forced my way through to the end. But the whole keep your powers till you need them device makes the player be much more safe in his playing. I like it.
Well, if you recall, like, one of the very first... I was still a guest on the show. I talked about Return to Dreamland. Mm-hmm. And I think I was talking about the hard mode. And that's exactly the kind of experience that you get when you play a Kirby game on hard mode. Like, the patterns of the enemies are a little bit more aggressive. And the bosses take so much damage that you have to be careful and you have to know precisely what you're doing and you have to understand how Kirby moves and how long it takes him to recover from using one of his abilities, because otherwise you're just going to run out of health before you can finish a boss.
That's like the polar opposite of Epic Yarn.
Right, but yeah, like in most Kirby games on the normal setting, you can just stand there and just absorb everything that they throw at you, and you can just smash a button, and at some point you're going to, you know, vanquish.
And that's been part of the DNA of Kirby since the very first game for Game Boy. It's that game is super easy. And
yep. But then you unlock the hard mode, and you realize, oh, wait, the game is actually kind of designed around the hard mode.
That is your thesis, sir.
I mean, I've seen games where you get the impression that it's built for the hard mode and not the normal mode. Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if this game, at least some thought was put into the level design based on playing it on hard.
Yeah, like the level design on hard mode in the first Kirby game just makes too much sense not to be really well thought out. Like you'll be tricked into swallowing an enemy in midair only to fall into a pit. Like, it's going to look like it's impossible to go around it unless you swallow him, but then you actually fall to your death because you can't float while you have an enemy inside you. So it's very, very clever.
It seems we have found the missing link between Kirby and Halo. Everybody gives Halo credit for this. You have to play it on the higher difficulties because that's where it's the most fun. That's what the game is designed around.
Oh.
You guys never heard that?
That's a tenuous connection, sir.
I understood it, but I just wanted to make you feel uncomfortable.
You can't make me feel uncomfortable.
That sounds like a challenge.
So we've talked about the powers, but I wanted to touch on the fact that I feel like the powers in this game are more fun to use than in a lot of other Kirby games, because a lot of the powers have more than one move you can do. And that's something that they brought over from Kirby Superstar, but I don't think there are that many Kirby games that really do this. I mean, a lot of the powers, you know, you can either do like a forward attack or maybe an up attack, or I don't know. I guess, like, for example, a cutter, you can steer your shots upward if you push up, and, you know, sword also has like the kind of the Smash Brothers up and then down swipe. that was not in Kirby's Adventure. So I really like that. I wish more Kirby games had that, because I feel like in a lot of Kirby games, there's only like maybe one or two powers that have kind of like this bizarre variety, like, you know, like the wrestling power up in Kirby's Adventure.
You, sir, need to play Return to Dreamland, because they bring that back in a big way. Like, they bring it back to the level that Superstar, you know, leveraged at. Because this game does have several moves per power-up, but it's still scaled back, I think, compared to Superstar.
Yeah, it is.
And it varies widely. I mean, some powers like Spark don't do anything. You're either sparking or you're not. Some of them, like fire, are really subtle, because with fire you can actually aim the flames up or down a little bit, but the game doesn't tell you that explicitly, and the effect is not very dramatic, so you might be doing it and not even realize you're doing it. There's stuff like Cutter. I always felt Cutter was like a really boring power in most Kirby games. Mm-hmm. In this one, I'm holding the button down longer to make it go farther, and then I'm like steering it with up and down to make it curve around platforms and hit switches from far away. That's crazy. That's awesome. Like, that's the kind of stuff I want to do in a Kirby game, you know?
Okay, like, my mind is blown. I didn't know that you can hold it for longer to throw it farther.
Yeah, and it kind of hints at that in the on the pause screen. If you go away from the map and you go back to the power description, it will give you some clues about the extent that you can of what you can do with these different powers, but it doesn't tell you everything. And you're meant to kind of experiment, but some of these things you may not ever realize, you know. So there's just a lot of really cool stuff with these, and you know, and then you've got stuff like Missile, which I think was new to this game. I'm not totally sure about
that. I think you're right, yeah.
But Missile is fun because it you know, you can just fly in any direction and you just destroy anything you hit. But it also has this very strong knockback whenever you slam into an enemy or a wall. And that can put you in a bad situation. So, and it moves so fast that you may not be able to steer quickly enough to go exactly where you want. So there's a feeling that this is a really cool power, but you have to be a little bit cautious with it. And I think that's just a great balance that a number of these abilities bring to the table. And it just makes the game a real joy for me, because I feel like in Amazing Mirror, I can never kind of sit back on my heels and just plow through it like I can with most other Kirby games, including the ones I like. I mean, I really like Kirby 64, but that's not a hard game. You know, and I love Epic Yarn, but oh my God, that's not a hard game. And that's the thing. I mean, to me, Kirby is the franchise is really more charm than substance. And this game is the one where they bring the substance up to the level of charm, and it works on both levels. And that's why this is my favorite Kirby game by a long shot.
I like more Kirby games than you do, I suppose, or rather I don't know, like some of them. It's not just a hard mode. Like, some of them are really have a smart fighting system that if you learn how to take advantage of it, then like it can be rewarding. But yeah, like Kirby games to me have usually been more of an action game than a platformer.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's actually about taking out the enemies, rather than making your way through a level.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd liken it more to a brawler. That's kind of interesting.
That's how it plays.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way.
And I don't like brawlers. This might explain everything. All right, so we didn't get to a lot of forum posts. We just kind of covered some of the ground. Sorry, everybody. But the forum thread is really interesting. I think it's nice to see people come around on the game as they play more of it and as they understand it better. I think, Guillaume, you had kind of had that experience, it seemed like, where you seemed to be really, really frustrated and hung up on it at first, and then you ended up being the one out of us who actually beat it for this feature.
Oh, really? I thought you had to beat games for Retroactive. I guess I won't...
Tell that to John!
I guess I won't put as much effort in the next ones. Yeah, like, the game is surprising, because initially it really... It kind of felt claustrophobic. I would keep going, you know, start from the beginning and try like the one door that I hadn't tried before. And it felt really small in scope. And the more I played, then the more the world opens up and the more I was just floored by how expansive it is. And that feeling kept going until almost right up to the end, because I guess I wasn't really paying close attention to different maps that I had and different worlds that I had actually visited. But, you know, like I had finished World 9 and Worlds 1 through 5, and I hadn't realized, oh, wait, I actually never set foot in World 6 and 7. And so, like, I felt like I was late in the game. But then it turned out, oh, wait, there's this big chunk of the middle that I haven't even, you know, like I haven't even seen yet. And so right. It felt like there was kind of the constant feel of discovery that I don't usually get from platformers, you know, like mm-hmm. usually you have, okay, there's 8 worlds in this game. And once you approach world 8, you've pretty much seen everything there is to see, unless there's some sort of unlockable world. And in this one, it was always kind of a surprise what they were going to throw at you next.
Yeah, I completely agree. So a couple other forum posts I do want to mention before we wrap this up. Klex Yoshi, who is a forum user who came out of hiding, made his first post in this thread to talk about Kirby and really, really likes the game. One thing I wanted to note from this poster is the idea of, you know, in the same way that Amazing Mirror is this sort of expansion and full realization of the Great Cave Offensive from Superstar, Klex Yoshi would sort of mention wishing that Nintendo would make a new Kirby game based on the idea of the Milky Way wishes from Kirby Superstar. And it's been a while since I played that one, but I think that's the one where you collect the powers and then
yes.
it's sort of like Mega Man, where now they're in your inventory and you can just switch to them anytime you want.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always felt that, like that was a structure that was a good idea that they never really implemented well in Superstar.
Right.
That allows you to do some really complicated puzzles, and they never really did much with it in that game.
Yeah, so that does seem like just really ripe for Nintendo to go back to that idea and say, you know, we can do some very cool things with this. And it in the same way that Amazing Mirror kind of pushes Kirby in the direction of like a Metroid game, or even a Zelda game, which would be the expertise of Flagship. I think that would push Kirby in the direction of like a Mega Man, where you have this developing tool set that you really have to learn to use, and you really have to understand the powers in terms of picking. Because even in Amazing Mirror, most of the time you're still kind of restricted to going with a power that's available. So it's some enemy that's around you, you know, and you have to figure out, well, of these 4 enemies that are in this area, which one is the best to use to go forward. But I think the idea of having essentially all of them, or having some finite set of them that you can pick from, and saying, okay, now I really have to know these powers so I know the right one to choose. That is really cool. Really cool. And I think on a modern system, you could probably, do some cool stuff with it and really pull it off. So
I have one thing I want to talk about before we close out.
Sure.
And we spoke about it a little bit at the beginning. It's the development studio that made this game. So I did some research because I like to do research. And the staff that made it, as Johnny sort of implied, got a bit scattered to the winds. However, a few of them landed at Nintendo, including the director of the last few Zelda games, which whose name is escaping me right now. But he worked on this game as well as the other flagship Nintendo collaborations. So Nintendo, it does appear, pillaged a decent number of flagship people when the company went down.
Good.
Which is kind of a model that it looked like they were following in that moment in time, where they would set up these partnerships with other companies, and then they would sort of spin off the people who were effective into their own second-party studios. You saw it with Brownie Brown, for example, where they sort of slowly assembled staff from these companies, from I guess it was Square at the time, mm-hmm. and then sort of put them into their own second party universe and said, okay, now you work for us. But it's an interesting approach to how Nintendo expanded their developer stable into a bit younger crowd, because obviously the director of this game is much younger than the other people responsible for the Zelda franchise.
But, yeah, even Aonuma is, I think, in his 50s now, so yep. he's been around for quite a while. So one last thought on Kirby and the Amazing Mirror from our friend Panderadox in the forums. I love the way he put this. The wonderlust of this game comes from going through a good chunk of these areas with different abilities. Being a wheel can change that level significantly than if you're using hammer. I think that's only speaking great volumes to the level design. And what I love about this quote from the forums is that it proves there's even yet another way to play this game and to enjoy it, which is not to be OCD about finding every single room and really mapping out everything, but to look at it as kind of a huge playground of Kirby levels that you can play through with a lot of different powers. And because the level designs are really nicely done and they're meant to be adaptable to playing through them with a lot of different powers, you can have a different experience every time you go through there. And I think the non-linearity of the game means that it's really nice to just open it up, pick a world at random, and just play through it with whatever powers you get, and not be worried about any kind of larger goals. And in that sense, you could maybe even play it like a more traditional Kirby game and still have a great time with it. So, it's a game that really does work on a lot of different levels. It's flawed, of course, like most good retroactive games are, and it's not going to work for everybody, but I think it is definitely a case of a game where it's worth your time to read up a little about it and do a little bit of study or just have the patience to stick with it for a couple of hours. And once you start to get a feel for how the game is constructed and how things fit together and what's going on, I think it really does open up, just like Guillaume said, and it becomes this huge world for you to explore. And it's just super fun to me. So, thanks everybody for participating and posting in the forum thread. I thought it was a really good one, and we're going to do another retroactive soon, so be on the lookout for that. I hope you enjoyed the feature. As always, let us know what you thought, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And the forum thread will stay open, so if you hear our praise and criticism of the game and think, man, I'd like to play that, you still can, and I think the forum thread is not only a great place to continue discussing the game, there's a lot of great tips and hints and just good advice to help you get started in that thread as well. So it's a good resource, and I hope you'll check it out. With that, we're going to wrap up the episode, and before we go, I want to reiterate that we will be returning to listener mail next week. It's been a couple of weeks, actually, since we did it. And we would love to hear from you. There's so much going on in the world of video games this time of year, with the Wii U coming out soon and eShop stuff going down, downloadable content for Mario. I'd love to hear what you think about all this stuff. So please send us an email at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com or head over to the show notes at the website and click on the link there. And very excited to announce that the annual NWR Telethon for Child's Play is returning this year. Be the third year in a row that we've done this. It is a huge production. It's really exciting for us. It's a live event where we will be podcasting for hopefully several hours. It'll be on a Saturday. It's going to be November 10th. And that's a week before Wii U comes out. So we're hoping that you won't have spent all of your money quite yet. And we hope it's a day that most of our fans and listeners will be able to come participate. We will try to do a recording of it, but you never know, things happen and we can't guarantee that. We're going to try our best to do a recording, but if it's at all possible for you to participate in the live event, I think it'll be well worth your time, because not only do you kind of get the thrill of not knowing what's about to happen and not knowing how the day is going to end up with the fundraising goals and all that, but we're going to have lots of surprises. We're going to have lots of listener interaction. We'll probably have people calling in. So if you want to talk to us or the other members of the staff or some of our special guests, I think you'll get a chance to do that. We're going to have trivia. There'll be prizes, lots of crazy stuff going on. So I really hope you will mark your calendar for November 10th. That's a Saturday. And it's the let's just say the time window of this event is large enough that you should be able to participate in at least part of it, regardless of where you live in the world.
Yes, yes.
That's how it's been the past couple years. So.
It's a long time commitment.
Yes, it is an all-day thing for us. So we hope that you will be able to participate for at least part of it. Of course, the whole point of doing it is not just to have a lot of fun and to do something ridiculous, which certainly is a factor. But we are hoping to raise a lot of money for a very worthy charity in Child's Play, which supplies toys and video games to kids who are in hospitals around the world, not just America. So it's a very great cause. Of course, it's a charity started by Gabe and Tycho from Penny Arcade. And it is nonprofit, and they do a wonderful job over there. So we have worked with them for the past couple of years. We're going to do so again, and we're hoping to raise a lot of money once again. So would really appreciate your consideration to contribute to this. There will be a page up on the website at Nintendo World Report very soon where we will open the fundraising early. So if you're worried that you're going to forget, or if you're not sure you'll be there on the day of the live event, you can go ahead and contribute early. Otherwise, you're certainly more than welcome to wait. And we'll do another thing where basically the amount of time that we stay on the air will be linked to how much money we raise. It's a really big show. It's a lot of fun putting it together, and we hope you'll support it. So head over to the website to find more about that, and we'll be giving you updates on it over the next couple of weeks. But you've got about a month to get ready for it. I hope you'll save your pennies and your dollars and your euros and yen and whatever else, and I hope you'll contribute to this. So look forward to hearing more about that very soon. But for now, we're going to say goodbye and thank our very good friend, TYP, for coming and helping us out on this episode.
You're welcome.
Mike, do you have your own podcast to pimp out a little bit?
Yes. I've recorded an episode with Zach Miller. I still got to get around to editing it, but you can look forward to that. It'll be fun. I think we had a really interesting lineup of games. So look forward to that. That'll, who knows, this weekend sometime probably it'll be up. So check that out.
You know, radio trivia is always a special event and always a treat to listen to.
It is tremendously fun.
I love it.
Excellent. Well, I am excited to hear that. So that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and thank you guys for being here. That's a wrap. We'll see you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
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 Jeez.
You asshole.
Oh, man.
Well done, sir.
So that's the one where he's got his zero suit and you're powerless for a while? Forget about it. Bad joke.
Okay. Anyway,
continue.